Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The great bald eagle may be symbolizing more than our nation's pride. Scientists around the Great Lakes are finding deformed baby eagles. Toxic pollution is considered the cause. And you can smell the roses, but Larry Somke prefers to eat his flowers. And heat pumps run by sewage in Switzerland.
In the whole Swiss country, we have 850 sewage treatment plants running now. 200 of these have the possibility of a heat recovery system, but only 10 of them have such a heat pump system.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Recently, four deformed baby eagles were found in nests along the shores of the Great Lakes in Michigan. Scientists monitoring the eagle population believe these eaglets are part of a much larger, much more critical story. Tim Eder, a regional executive of the National Wildlife Federation, says the eaglets were found during routine inspections of eagles that have been banded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The two birds on Lake Erie had twisted beaks, severely twisted beaks, where the top beak crosses over and doesn't align with the lower beak. And that was also found in a third eagle in northern Michigan. There was a fourth bird with deformities, and this deformity has never been found in bald eagles before. It's been seen in some other birds. But this bird had a malady similar to clubbed feet. Two of its toes were shortened, one of its toes was longer than it should have been, and they were kind of curled. The toes and claws were curled up. So this bird can't really even stand up, let alone hunt.
As concerning as this discovery is, says Eder, it is part of a developing case study.
Actually, we've seen this deformity, twisted beaks, in other birds like cormorants and terns and herring gulls. In fact, scientists from around this region have found deformities or reproductive problems or population declines in 16 different species of wildlife, birds, mammals, and reptiles included.
Eder is increasingly concerned about recent developments, especially as he has been studying the eagle population for many years now.
One of these nests was on a platform, an artificial nesting platform that I erected in a tree back in 1982. We put up six artificial nesting platforms in 1982 in hopes of bringing eagles back to the shores of the Great Lakes. And we put them in what we considered to be prime nesting locations and good habitat based on historic nesting records. And at the time, we knew that DDT had been banned, and we expected to see bald eagles making a rebound. And indeed, they have made a rebound. But what's happening with the bald eagle population in Michigan and throughout the Great Lakes region is that the population is expanding, but the growth is coming from inland, from interior sites away from the Great Lakes.
So you found that the growth there in inland is healthy, tends to be healthy?
Yeah, it does tend to be healthy. The birds inland are feeding on a much cleaner food supply. What happens, though, is that the birds move into Great Lakes shoreline nesting communities or nesting locations on tributaries that are fed by salmon and trout that live in the open waters of the lakes and come up to spawn. And in those nests, we see problems.
All right, now, here's the question. What is or who is the smoking gun?
Well, the smoking gun in this case is PCBs. PCBs are a chemical that was widely used in many different manufacturing and industrial applications. Unfortunately, we can't pinpoint what industry or city dumped the PCBs that poisoned these eagles, because PCBs were so ubiquitous. They were used there are millions of pounds of PCBs that are out there in the environment. And unfortunately, they're still in use, and they're still being discharged. Even though we banned PCBs, they're still being discharged.
PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, are a form of halogenated hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons that contain halogens. The four most common halogen elements are chlorine, bromine, fluorine, and iodine. Halogenated hydrocarbons turn up in plastics, such as polyvinyl chloride, pesticides, electrical insulation, and hydraulic fluids, for example. PCB, desired especially for its heat-resistant property, was invented by the Monsanto Company. As with all halogenated hydrocarbons, PCBs are extremely stable. They do not break down in the environment once they are discharged. In fact, not only don't they break down, they bioaccumulate in the food chain. When consumed, PCBs bind with proteins in the body and remain in the body. The more PCB-laden food is consumed, the more PCBs are stored in the body. When this happens low on the food chain, the PCBs are then passed along to higher and higher life forms, accumulating in larger and larger amounts in the process. Eder says, at this stage, eagles have something in common with another very familiar life form.
These bald eagles are at the very pinnacle of the food chain. In fact, they're at the same level as humans. People eat the same fish that these eagles are eating, and people are exposed to these chemicals to the same extent that that these eagles are. The only difference is that eagles aren't very good with a fillet knife, so they don't skin their fish, they don't trim away the fatty parts or the organs that may contain higher amounts of contaminants. But that doesn't, even proper cleaning methods don't adequately protect people. And we have seen evidence of contamination problems in people in the Great Lakes region.
As PCBs in the Great Lakes are so common, coming from all manner of sources, even airborne from far away, it is difficult to point the accusing finger at any one factory or any one company.
But we do know, for example, that the city of Detroit, which operates the largest sewage treatment plant in the Great Lakes Basin, discharges as much as a half a pound of PCBs every day, and that goes directly into Lake Erie.
As is the case with most forms of toxic pollution, the answer to the PCB problem in the Great Lakes lies not with efforts to clean up the existing mess, but in preventing a mess from developing in the first place. To this end, says Eder, there is a process already underway called the Great Lakes Water Quality Initiative.
The Water Quality Initiative is a set of rules, new rules to control toxic dumping proposed by US EPA. They proposed these rules in draft form in April. They're out for public review right now. This is the public comment period between now and September 13th. EPA is accepting official comments on them. And these new rules will do a number of things to prevent these deformities in bald eagles and other wildlife. They will, for example, cut toxic dumping from all toxic pollutants from all cities and industries by about 80%. They target especially those chemicals that build up in the food chain. There are a number of special provisions that go after chemicals that are what we call bioaccumulative. Also, the Great Lakes Initiative will, for the first time, set water quality standards specifically designed to protect wildlife. Currently, we don't do that. We only protect human health and fish, aquatic life. We don't protect wildlife when we set water quality standards. But the Great Lakes Initiative would fix that. But first of all, it has to get adopted.
If it were adopted, how would this be enforced, however?
It would be enforced by the states throughout the Great Lakes region. This would be a set of federal rules that each of the Great Lakes states would have to enforce. And the way they do that is through issuance of discharge permits, control permits to cities and industries. But US EPA retains oversight over the program, so either US EPA or the states could enforce these permits.
Tim Eder, Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes region, Michigan and Ohio. He is also Director of the Federation's Water Quality Program. PCBs were commercially available first in 1929. A suspected carcinogenic material, PCBs were banned in the United States in 1977. They are still in the environment. In fact, a 1991 report to the Canadian government documented the presence of PCBs in the Arctic. This is Bruce Robertson. There's nothing like a garden you can really use. That's what Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says about a special flower bed he has growing out back. Get ready to do some tasting, he said. We're not sure what is going to happen, but let's see.
Larry's down on his knees here. Good morning, Larry. What are you doing?
Oh, hi. I'm doing a little gardening here in my herb garden. I'm trying to get the soil worked up and get ready and do a little... I'm moving some little alpine strawberry plants over into my herb garden.
Wait. Strawberries in an herb garden?
Yeah, these are the little tiny alpine strawberries that are not like big old production strawberries. They're more delicate. They're a little bit smaller. They have these tiny little fraise de bois berries. And then their leaves are very good in tea. So they're, to me, I consider them to be an herb, and I'm going to put them right here in my herb garden. So you just dig a nice hole, get everything ready, spread them out a little bit, just bury them in there, pat the dirt around it.
Now, quick question here. This is sort of the middle of the summer. It's
right.
Real hot. Is this a good time to work and plant an herb garden?
Well, usually you try to do something earlier or later, but... You know, now is a very good time to put in an herb garden because, especially the perennials, like these strawberries and this lemon balm that I have here and sage. You know, if you go to your lawn and garden center now, they still have all these plants. So now, actually, I think, because it's a little quieter, it's not so busy, now is a good time to either establish your herb garden or expand it, like I'm doing, by putting in these strawberries.
So what else you got here in your herb garden?
Well, I've got some annuals here, like this fresh basil, and you can see there's parsley. But I have some unusual stuff in here, at least I think it's unusual. Lemon balm is not all that bizarre, but at least it has a nice lemony, leafy look to it. It's really good in tea and good in potpourri. This is sage right here. It has the nice sort of grayish leaves, and these plants are doing really well. Those are both perennials. They'll stay here for a long time. But out here in the middle of it, and you can see my garden. I don't keep a big herb garden. I believe the garden should be small. This one's about, 6 feet or 7 feet by 7 feet, kind of in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
So I could, in as much as I possibly can. This is borage, or borage, and this is a nice kind of fleshy, you know, kind of funny, crinkly type of leaf plant that has a nice cucumber smell. It's good in salads, but also good in tea and potpourri.
Smells a little bit like cucumber.
Yeah, it has a kind of a cucumbery scent.
And you would, use the leaf?
Use the leaf, right. Yeah. And the flower, too. You know, more and more people are eating the flowers off of these plants. This has a lovely blue flower. It's really very attractive. So you could toss a few of those in a salad, too. The next to that is bergamot, or monarda, or better known as bee balm. It sort of grows up about 3 feet high, 2.5 to 3 feet high. Once again, virtually indestructible, nice perennial plant. Bees and butterflies just love it. It's a wonderful plant if you want to attract those kind of animals to your backyard.
Or what else here?
Right here, you're just about standing on the hyssop, anise hyssop, which is a beautiful plant that I just got introduced to last year, but it has these lovely little blue blossoms. And then the leaves, you can smell, they smell a little bit like licorice.
Like the licorice smell,
yeah. Yeah, it's a real nice little fragrance.
Yep, it does.
I like that. It's a nice plant. More and more, I like to grow my herbs as ornamentals. I like the beautiful blossoms that come on the herbs. I don't see them just as production. You know, I'm going to get food out of them. I love the blossoms on herbs, too, which is a good reason to grow an herb garden because herbs are virtually indestructible. The bugs don't bother them, and they also have beautiful flowers. Now, here's a little part of the herb garden that's sort of my little culinary corner. This is tarragon. This is French tarragon, and that's a perennial.
French tarragon.
French tarragon as opposed to the Russian tarragon. Most people find Russian tarragon when they're at the lawn and garden center. So when they do go buy it, be sure you're getting French tarragon because it has a much different flavor. It also has sort of a licorice-y, anise kind of flavor. Here's another little pretty plant. This is a burnet, salad burnet, and that also has a beautiful little blossom. You can see these little guys. And then there's the leaf there, nice little soft leaf. I like to pick a lot of that and put it in my salad. I also, since it has a cucumbery flavor, instead of just putting vinegar on herbs, try some of this on, vinegar on cucumbers. Add this to cucumbers, and then it has sort of a nice symbiotic fragrance builder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is oregano. This is Greek oregano or pizza oregano. And once again, you have to be careful when you go to the lawn and garden center.
To specify Greek?
Yes, yep. Because oftentimes you'll get the common oregano that just does not have the flavor. It doesn't dry well, doesn't give you the flavor you're really going for. So make sure you get Greek oregano when you go. And that also, that's a party plant. Once you get that established, that'll try to take over your whole garden. So anybody can grow oregano. coming around here, this is a volunteer of a dill plant. And right now it's gone to seed, which means I could use it in pickles. But the little, feathery, delicate feathery leaves are also great to put fresh on salads and soup, to give cream soups a nice little fragrance. And here, now I like to, like I said before, I like to mix up my herbs. A friend gave me two habanero peppers. And these are two little pepper plants. And they produce the hottest peppers known to man or woman. And I put them over here in my herb garden because I just think they're going to be nifty addition to my herb garden. I think people should mix it up a little bit with their garden. Don't always try to do the same thing like everybody else does. Then, of course, here's thyme. Every thyme is a great little plant that's a nice perennial. Once you get it in, it's very lovely and it spreads. I have rosemary. I have another thyme. And then this is sorrel. This is a French, it's very common and popular in France. That's kind of a lemony, peppergrass kind of flavor.
Oh, yeah.
It's great chopped in soups right at the very last minute. It's great in butter sauces. Sorrel, salmon with butter sorrel sauce is a very popular French kind of dish. And that grows really easy, too. You can get that at any lawn and garden center. And once it's established, it keeps coming back and back and back and back and back. So there's my herb garden.
Well, Larry, it looks really good, and I'm sure it tastes really good, too.
It does taste.
Over the course of the summer and through the winter, if you put them up in dried herbs and such.
Yes, now's a great time to start harvesting your herbs. And as a matter of fact, maybe later on this summer, we can do something on drying herbs. I could get some information on that, because I always love to dry my herbs and then give them away as Christmas presents.
Sounds good. Get back to your strawberries.
All right. Thanks
a
lot.
See you next time,
Larry. I'm going to get some water on them.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His tasty garden is out back of his home in Hollowville, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. A suburban community on the Lake of Geneva in western Switzerland has been testing a system that turns sewage into electrical energy. From Swiss Radio International, Julie Hunt begins at the beginning.
The next time you flush the toilet, think about the fact that what comes out of your body could be used to heat a whole community, but not without a considerable initial financial outlay. In the small community of Clarens, near Montreux, four huge buildings are heated by water pumps, which take in treated sewage. The energy created by cooling the sewage water is added to energy from the national grid, and the resulting energy pool is used to heat water fed into the pump on the other side. The system was installed by the Electricity Society for Western Switzerland, with the help and advice of water pump manufacturers York International. Denis Perrin, an engineer for York, showed me how the system works.
We are now in the sewage station of Montreux, and this sewage station is for 40,000 persons. We are near the heat pump, and the heat pump must heat in the system upstairs where we have offices and so.
After treatment in this place,
yes,
the sewage, which is quite clear water, I understand, goes into the heat pumps.
Yes, it's clear water, but not drinking water.
Okay. And then the heat pump takes some of the energy from cooling that water.
Yes. For instance, its base is 3 kilowatts through the heat pump, and then the heat pump needs 1 kilowatt, and they gives 4 kilowatts in the heating system. I mean, the efficiency is 1 to 4.
Is that good?
Yes, now it's very good, but in 5 years, perhaps, we have a higher level temperature of the sewage, and it will be still better.
How will you raise the temperature?
Oh, by separating the rainwater of the wastewater.
So in the future,
yes,
separate pipes will take the rainwater from the gutters straight into the lake?
Yes, direct, yes. Now we are at the end of the process, a treatment process of the sewage water, and we have clear water that would be collected in a big pipe and distributed in the four building, main building here, for heating.
All of which have separate heat pumps.
Yes, we have separate heat pumps. In every building, one heat pump.
So I'm very glad to say that we've just come out of the sewage works, which doesn't smell too good, does it? All in the name of journalism, of course. And we're looking down at the channel through which the water is conducted to the four different heat pumps.
The temperature of the water here is minimum 11 degrees. Now it's 14 degrees before cooling.
Perhaps we're in one of the most important parts of the building here, because it's where the heat pumps have been installed, and there's a huge amount of equipment here, all painted blue. This is the building of the Society for Electricity in the western part of Switzerland.
The heat pump is for the whole building, the office and the conference room and so on.
Is it a cheap system to operate?
Yes, it's rather a cheap system.
How does it compare, for instance, with using oil for heating?
Oh, with the price, it's almost now, today, is almost the same price. But as you know, the oil price has quite a lot of fluctuations.
The other thing, of course, is that oil is one of the Earth's natural resources, and the idea is to save that.
Yes, it's also a question of environment.
There are no side effects, then, of this process?
We use R22, and it's a refrigerant that have a very low influence on the ozone depletion and a global warming system.
So you're using a toxic substance to promote the refrigeration?
Yes, but not so toxic as the other refrigerant that we used before. Now the R22 is permitted till 2020.
Do you have anything in mind that you could use instead?
Yes, it's possible to use the R134A. This refrigerant is still in experimentation, and it's rather expensive to use it.
This particular heating project in Clarens was financed by the beneficiaries. The commune of Montreux owns the sewage works and the huge new catering school, still under construction. The other buildings are controlled by the electricity company and the local bus society. The total cost of installing the pumps in the four buildings was 4.5 million francs. I asked Mr. Perrin to what extent the heating system could be further extended.
The actual possibility of the sewage treatment plant is 5 megawatt. We use only 1.6 megawatt now. I mean, we have the possibility of extension, but only in this neighborhood.
So that many of the houses of Montreux could be heated in this way if they're in the vicinity of this sewage plant?
I see perhaps still 10 buildings can be heated by this system.
What's the potential for developing further plants of this kind in Switzerland?
In the whole Swiss country, we have 850 sewage treatment plants running now. 200 of these have the possibility of a heat recovery system, but only 10 of them have such a heat pump system. They are all situated in the east part of Switzerland, and this is the first one in the west part.
That report prepared by Julie Hunt for Swiss Radio International. And that is our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 185. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.